Hey,
David Blankenhorn.
Hey, Glenn. How you doing?
Doing well, doing well. This is Glenn Lowry here at bloggingheads.tv on the Glenn Show, and it's my pleasure to welcome for a conversation today David Blankenhorn, who is president of the Institute for American Values in New York City, and who is the author of a book just published about casinos in New York State, New York's Promise: Why Sponsoring Casinos is a Regressive Policy Unworthy of a Great State. Welcome, David.
Great. Good to be with you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's good to have you, old friend, and good to see that the Institute for American Values, as maybe Pope Francis has encouraged us, isn't just narrowly focused on issues of gay marriage and abortion, but is casting its critical net a little bit wider than that.
There's another issue or two out there under heaven.
There are. Listen, why don't you tell us a little bit, what's the issue with casinos? I thought they were very popular. There's one springing up on every corner, it seems. Cities, states, and so forth, they're relying on them for revenues. The people are flocking to them with so much fun. What's the beef?
Right. Well, the beef is that these institutions are hurting people. They are contributing to the rise of inequality in the society. They are institutions that take from the have-nots and give to the haves, and they are completely the instruments of government. You know, I mean, in other words, a lot of things that contribute to inequality today, like, you know, global trends of this or that, you know, public policy can only indirectly affect. But these casinos that exist to raise money for the state contribute to inequality, and they are entirely creatures of public policy. So we could do something. All we have to do is just stop it. And, you know, 23 states have rushed into this in recent years. And New York may, I hope not, but may become the 24th in November. And I just think it is, I think it's honestly one of the worst public policies in the American states today.
I'm going to encourage you to tell us why, beyond the observations that you've just made, that it's an unfair way of raising money from, you know, lower income people in the society and so forth. But I want to ask you first, you're saying casinos and you're not saying lotteries. And I'm hard pressed to see exactly what the distinction would be. Why would your criticism not extend to the state reliance on lotteries?
It does. It does, Glenn. Lotteries are the same thing, just a different form of gambling, but it's the same principle. The state lotteries suffer from the same inequities that we're talking about with casinos. It's just that casinos are on the public radar now in New York and a number of states. And
yeah.
Also, you know, there's something about slot machines that seems to be a little more addictive than, you know, scratch tickets and lottery tickets. I know some people spend a lot of money on the lottery, but these slot machines, I mean, people say casinos, but casinos today are overwhelmingly just big rooms full of slot machines. And these modern slot machines are really highly addictive, to the point that depending on the study, anywhere from 35 to 55% of all casino gambling revenue today comes from problem gamblers. These are people that have really serious personal problems with gambling, and that's, you know, about half of the money. You're right. There's nothing in principle different with a lottery program, and it's just as wrong. And the state, in my view, should not be sponsoring lotteries either.
Let me play the devil's advocate with you a little bit here. This is the libertarian. This is what I think might be called a libertarian response, which is that people are adults. Nobody is being coerced. They're getting benefit as they see it. Now, you've called attention to problem gamblers, so we may say they're not entirely rational. So addiction, right?
Right.
So we know that that leaves a person not competent to make a judgment about their own well-being. And perhaps ultimately your argument is resting on paternalism. But I don't want to put words into your mouth. The libertarian critique would be people are making free choices. They're grown-ups. They're adults. They're getting a benefit out of it. This is consumption. This, you know, who are we to say how a person should find happiness? You say it's harmful to people, but the harm is at least not immediately evident. Okay, if someone goes into bankruptcy because they can't stop gambling, that certainly is a harm. But is that the case for most of the people who walk through a casino door? And so if people are making the choices that they want to make, and if they're getting services that they're willing to pay for, what's wrong with allowing them to have those services and raising money thereby?
Well, the libertarian argument that you just articulated eloquently, I might add, is, I think, valid when it comes to recreational gambling. It, you know, if you and I want to get together and play poker, or yeah. if we want to bet on the Super Bowl, or if we want to have an office pool on who's going to win a certain game or cross the finish line first, or if we want to have a bet, a wager on whether it's going to rain in Spain next week, I have no problems with it, and our state laws have no problems with it. So the freedom to gamble is not an issue here. What is at issue is whether the state, in the name of citizenship, in the name of the public good, allows commercial gambling operations to come in and set up games that are rigged in favor of the house. You know, you can't beat a slot machine. If I play poker with you, I might win. But you can't beat a slot machine. All that happens with the slot machine is that it takes my money. Because you're betting against a computer that has been rigged to make sure that you lose.
Yeah, I mean, as the statistician in me wants to say, you can't beat it over the long run. If you happen to get lucky and win early on, you can beat it if you got sense enough to quit while you're ahead. But no one does.
Well, very few people do. And you know that there is a mathematical law called the law of gambler's ruin, which says that yes. this law that you just said, that is the steady gambler will eventually lose everything. And so they yeah. say, well, what's the best thing for the gambler? The best thing for the gambler is to wager the amount you want to win on one bet. So if you want to win at a slot machine, if you want to win $100 on a slot machine, the best thing for you to do is to go into a casino where you can bet $100 on one spin of the slot machine, which you can do.
And walk out no matter what
they are. And bet $100 and walk out. That is statistically your best bet, your best chance of winning. So, but very few people do that. And most people, and now don't forget, Glenn, here another really important thing to keep in mind is that historically, when people think of casino gambling, they think of Las Vegas and Atlantic City, where, you know, for 99% of Americans, that means like taking a trip, getting on an airplane and, you know, going or taking a long trip. And you get there, you stay for a couple of days, and you spend whatever you're going to spend at the casinos, and you come home. These regional casinos are close by. And so instead of going once or twice a year, you're going yeah. once or twice or three times a week. That's yeah. where they're at. And these are local people. See, these are not, you know, you think about the old movies, you know, you see of, you know, bejeweled women and men in tuxedos. You know, if you go to these casinos that are being built now, these are local people. They tend to be disproportionately low-wage workers, retirees, minorities, and women. And these are not the affluent, you know, members of society. These are the people who are already struggling enough, thank you, yeah. in out there. And we are setting up these institutions near them, in their neighborhoods, luring them in there with advertisements that would absolutely not be permitted by you know, private sector actors. But because these are state supported, they see there's, oh, you can't lose, you could be a millionaire, and so forth, luring them in there to lose their money in slot machines. So, and let's just be honest, why? So that we can keep our property taxes lower. And there's a fundamental ethical issue here. Is that, you know, yes, we need to raise money for our state services, but is this the way to do it? Are we going to take advantage of people who are the least able to pay in this way? And, you know, yes, no one makes them go into the casino. That's true. But there is a tremendous advertising campaign, including, you know, governors who say, and legislators who say, oh, we love casinos. Casinos help everybody. Please go gamble in the casino. So they do, and they're you know, also, you know, I looked into why people do this. And, you know, some people suffer from depression. Some people have a lot of worries in life. Some people are desperate. Some people have just, I mean, some people, you know, people suffer. People suffer in this world. And sometimes the kind of escape that is involved in going to a casino and sitting in front of these machines with bright lights and so forth, it is something that people do in order to kind of escape from troubles or worries, or to be place a desperate hope that something big's going to happen, maybe believe in some kind of dream of instant riches, or just to, so this, the psychology of this, of you know, let's just call it a normal human instinct. Let's just call it something that is deep in all of us. But this, you know, historically, the public good has been seen as we need to make sure that this is, you know, minimized. We need to make sure that this remains private and local and recreational and not public and political and universal, so that we are become addicted to this as a way to pay for our government.
A couple of aspects of your critique that I think are particularly compelling to me and interesting to explore. One of them is this class differentiation, which is that the state needs to raise money. There are a lot of ways it can do it. Some of them are less transparent than others. So direct taxes on people, that's very transparent and clear to see. Indirect taxes through something like luring people into casinos and then taking 20 cents on the dollar or whatever right. it is. Maybe it's probably more like 50 cents on the dollar. Right. I don't know the exact, but, you know, the house take versus what gets paid out. That's another way of raising money. It's less transparent, but it's also regressive, you're saying, in that it targets the weakest, least advantaged people in society because they're the ones who perhaps most need the kind of hope, the kind of empty hope, ultimately, I find most attractive or difficult to resist, the kind of empty hope that's being sold at the casino. And also because if you go to these other people and you ask them to pay directly for the services that they're benefiting from, they might vote you out of office.
Exactly.
So there's something that's especially pernicious in that political jujitsu that just got worked, where, you know, we're taxing the poor to pay for services to the middle class.
Exactly. And, you know, I had a, you know, there's a guy in Washington named Grover Norquist, and he's the big leader of the, you know, every tax is immoral. There's no such, every taxes.
So where does he stand on this?
Are horrible. Well, a few months ago, he wrote a letter. I'd be really interested to know who funded this. He wrote a letter to every state legislator in the great state of Texas. And it said, "Dear legislator, as you know, taxes are terrible. People who support taxes go straight to hell. Taxes are against, you know, God's plan for the world.
As you know.
World. And however, you may be wondering how to pay for government. Here's a way to do it. Spread casinos all over Texas. That's the great free market way of paying for government."
He's being ironic.
No, he was not being ironic. He meant it. And it just makes, it just enrages me. Number one, the idea that we...
So he's selling the idea, states financier school districts or whatever through casinos so that you can lower people's taxes.
Yes.
He doesn't realize that those are taxes, too.
Well, I don't know if he realizes or not, but he says in the letter that they're not. And, of course, they are. It's like an excise tax. It's a tax, like as you said, like any other tax. But it, because the
you're voluntarily
because
paying.
The politicians call it this other thing, you know, they see it, they can treat it. They don't have to go and be held accountable in the same way for this.
Well, you could call it a sin tax, like a tax on tobacco
right.
or a tax on
right.
alcohol.
Right, exactly. So, and also, you know, Glenn, if one of the things I got into this.
But excuse me for interrupting, David. The state is not out there promoting for people to smoke or promoting for people to drink in order to collect the tax revenue.
What if it said? What if it said? What if it said that the state of Massachusetts is really wants you to smoke a lot of cigarettes and drink a lot of alcohol. In fact, we'll send a car to your house to give you a free ride to the bar. Or we will give you extra points if you'll just smoke two or three packs a day so that that can help little Johnny go to school. That would be the equivalent of what we're now doing with these casinos. So there's a very, you know, serious ethical issue involved. You know, when in the class issue is everywhere you look. I mean, 2 years ago, before I got into this, I never set foot into a casino. And I'll tell you, I know I'm in the college-educated, you know, upscale, more affluent America, and I don't know anybody who goes to them, anyone. So you have a thing where the people who are making the decisions about starting these casinos and spending the money that comes from them and opining in the newspapers about whether we do or we don't need them, these are the people who themselves never, ever go to them. You know, when's the last time you saw a politician at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a casino or putting his own or her own money in a slot machine or having a photo opportunity near it? You never see these things because this is a policy that they're kind of ashamed of. Even if they want it, they know it's seamy and kind of something they don't want to be around. They don't want to be associated with it personally. What they do, they just want the money.
All right, so now I'm looking at your table of contents of the book. You've got a chapter called Gamble Speak, in which you, if you will, deconstruct a lot of the kind of euphemistic language that floats around the casino talk. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I got real interested in the word, in the words, because the gambling interests have created a kind of inverse universe of meanings. So they've taken all the key words, starting with gambling, and just turned them inside out. So let's just start with gamble. Gambling, and the word gamble and its cognates. The gambling industry never uses this word anymore. They call it gaming.
Yes, they do.
And so, like, it's kind of an entertainment.
I'm sorry, what's the significance of that sleight of hand of moving from a direct and unvarnished reference to gambling to talking about, you know, like going to the ballpark?
Well, because gambling is a specific form of a financial exchange, and it's what you economists, I think, would call a non-instrumental financial exchange. Therefore, the financial exchange involved in gambling is not I buy the ticket so I get to see the concert, I pay the fee in order to get to play the game. The gambling is simply an economic transfer where I lose and you gain. And there's it's not in the transfer is not in the service of some other thing. They want to, first of all, be rid of the historic associations with organized crime and dishonesty and deceptiveness. Because if you look at the history of the word, gambling doesn't mean a person who takes risks. A gambler, in the Oxford English Dictionary, the historic meaning of it is a person who cheats another person in a game of chance. It's a cheater. That's who a gambler is, a cheater.
Or, if I may, an especially skilled player of a game of chance who knows that the odds favor him because of his exceptional skill.
Well,
I mean, that's what Texas Hold'em or something like that. You know, it's very hard to cheat at that game, but some people make a good living playing.
I would say that is a little bit different, Glenn, in that that involves a skill, you know? In other words, poker. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Not a slot machine. Not sitting at a roulette.
Right. Not like
you're playing against
on,
other people and you're using your
hands. Skill. Okay. When skill is involved, the more skill is involved, the less legitimate it is to call it gambling. You could call it betting on whether or not you could, you know, lift a heavier weight and so on. But we're talking about a game of chance. In the historic meaning of a gambler is a cheat, someone who cheats others. There's a great book out that was written in the 1930s called Gamblers Never Gamble. And it just means that the last thing on earth a casino is going to do is take a risk. Casinos only bet on sure things. And so they want, and because the public there's a kind of a tectonic level in which the public still knows all these things. They want to sanitize the word, and so they call it gaming. And they say, oh, well, Glenn, some people like to go to movies, some people like to go to the opera, and some people enjoy being entertained at the casino. But they don't tell you that that's a category mistake. You don't put your money in a slot machine in order to buy a ticket for something else to happen. All it is you're hoping that the slot machine will pay out more than you put in, which isn't going to happen over time. So it's a non-instrumental exchange. It's just any thrill that comes with it is just the thrill of the financial exchange itself. So it'd be an example like, what if you liked lawnmowers and you went to a hardware store and you bought a lawnmower and you had a thrill because you bought the lawnmower?
I'm going to argue with you for a minute. Let's get rid of all the governments and all the Native American reservations and such, and let's just have a bunch of people. Let's suppose that they're all more or less poor, but they can scrape together $5 or $10. Somebody comes along and says, hey, everybody, I tell you what. We're going to all put our $5 in this pot, and one of us is going to walk away with the sum. Okay, it's going to be a raffle or a lot drawing or whatever it is. We're going to pool our funds voluntarily, and one of us will walk away with the sum. And oh, by the way, I'm going to take 5% for having been the clever fellow to think up this idea or whatever. And people put their money in the pot knowing exactly what the rules are. Now, mind you, 5% is not the same as 50%. Right. I grant you that. Right. I grant you that. But my point here is a matter of principle. I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that people, maybe they're poor people, maybe they're people in a developing country somewhere, rural population or whatever it is. In fact, I think we can point to institutions of, rotating credit and things like this, where people do meet every month. They do put their money into a pot together, and one of them does, draw a lot and walk out the lucky winner that day with the pot. Now, in those institutions, usually there's some kind of commitment over time so that everybody gets a chance to win the pot eventually if they stay in the thing long enough. So it's not gambling. I'm not saying it's gambling. But I am saying that the taking of this kind of risk might be something that a person, if they were pressed hard enough against the margins and they have very little reason to hope, I'm never going to accumulate enough to get a car if I save, 20% of what I'm earning day to day because I earn barely nothing. But if I take a week's pay and put it in this pot, maybe I'll be the lucky one. You never know. And, I don't know that I would want to try to keep people from doing that to the extent that it gave them hope. So I'm making the case not for the government necessarily to do this, but for the idea that gambling, just straight up gambling, is selling people hope. And maybe in a situation in which there's little else to hope for, that's not the worst thing in the world. So I just put that out there for you to refute.
Well, look, there's a difference between hope as a virtue. Hope one is taught in the great theological traditions. Hope aligns somewhat with realism when it is connected to the other virtues. If one hopes to solve one's financial or personal problems through putting one's money in slot machines, that does not align with realism. And so therefore it becomes particularly, evil or wrong or deeply, deeply immoral for the state to engage in that kind of activity. Now, I've seen, and you have too, this happen with people. And to be honest with you, I'd rather have, when I was a community organizer in Dorchester, Massachusetts, people played the numbers and they were, get a call in the afternoon and they would, and to me, I don't think that was a great idea, but at least it was a private and local activity that people organized. I mean, I'm not trying to sanitize it. I'm not trying to say it was a good thing. I actually don't think it was a good thing. But I would take a local policy game in a low-income neighborhood run by semi-legal entities in those groups in those neighborhoods. I'll take that over governor saying, please play the lottery to send little Johnny to school any day of the week.
I got made two observations here, because I think what you're saying now about rooting hope in some realistic understanding and, you know, perception about how the world is actually working.
Right.
It resonates with me. I heard a sermon recently in which the parson was making a distinction between what he called miracle thinking and what he called magical thinking. And the distinction came down to miracle thinking is when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing every day, kind of within God's plan for your life, is how you would put it. And you have hope that the divine powers are going to open up a door that's been previously foreclosed. So you're praying for this miracle. You're praying, but you're praying within the context of a structured set of activities that are all consistent with the thing being achieved.
Yes.
Okay. So maybe the Lord, quote unquote, will come in and the miracle, quote unquote, will happen. Magical thinking is completely divorced from the actual structures of what makes things happen in the world. You just expect the skies to open up and manna to fall down on you. Okay, those are completely different, you know, kind of existential postures for a person to adopt. And let me just finish the point. For the state to be engaged in the promotion as a pedagogic matter of miracle thinking in the population. You never know. Yes. You never know. Not with respect to your own effort, not with respect to going to night school, not with respect to saving, not with respect to starting a business, not with respect to seeing your kids get to, you know, a decent education or whatever it is, but with respect to simply manna falling out of the sky from heaven and these big mega bucks prizes and all of this is just furthering the temptation. You too can be a billionaire, not by coming up with a new idea, not by patenting something, not by taking a risk, not by long nights of endeavor, but simply by the sky opening up and following you. Well, that's a horrible message to be saying to a population of people who really do have it within their power to place themselves in a position where, quote unquote, a miracle might change their lives.
Right. And one of them aligns with what might actually happen if connected to effort and reward and a supportive environment. I mean, this is not only what you're describing as the miracle thinking. When you promote it as a matter of policy in the state, you're not only bypassing opportunities to promote positive kinds of effort on the part of the citizens, you're actually attacking it. You're actually attacking the ethic that's required. And also, you know what else you're saying? You're saying that we're not all in this together. You're saying that it's okay to divide the society up between the people being fleeced and the people doing the fleecing. And the people doing the fleecing make these clever messages to try to get the people being fleeced to hand over their money. There's a cynicism in this that I think deserves to be called out.
Tell us a little bit about, and perhaps we could then conclude, about Governor Cuomo's casino plan and the state of play in policy development in New York State now.
Well, you know, the Constitution prohibits commercial casinos in New York.
I didn't know that.
And that has not stopped the government from setting up 9 of them so far. They just call them racinos because they're the casinos, which say casino. It's really hilarious when you actually visit them. But they're next to a racetrack. And so somehow they got a legal ruling that said these aren't casinos. But I guess they're out of racetracks now. So,
oh, paramutual betting is already going on at the track. This is just an extension.
They view it as an extension of the lottery, actually. And they connect it to, like you said before, there is so many parallels between slot machines and lotteries. So they got a court to say this was related to the lottery. So they set them up at the racetracks. But now they want to abolish the constitutional prohibition entirely and create a string of casinos. And Governor Cuomo has said shamelessly, just shamelessly, that this is about promoting economic development in upstate New York.
Yeah.
Whereas there's not a study in the world, you know as an economist, there's not a study in the world that suggests that casinos over time contribute positively to economic growth. You do have to hire people to work in the casinos, but since casinos don't produce things of value and since they generate social problems, It's the worst possible way to think about it.
I suppose somebody might argue that the XYZ conventioners will choose New York over Las Vegas. I don't know what the evidence is.
Governor Cuomo has said that frequently, that somehow these are going to be all about attracting tourists. But the evidence of the other states that do this pretty decisively refutes that. Most of the people who visit regional casinos are people who live in the region. And even in Mississippi, where they have a very highly developed casino market on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, for example, and they actually do have conventioneers come, even there. Nine casinos in the state of in the little town of Biloxi, Mississippi. It looks like a little Las Vegas down there. Even there, most of the people who come there live within 100 miles of the casino. So regional casinos attract people from the region. And the other just comical, kind of cynical thing that happened was, in the language of the amendment, they actually are writing into the wording on the ballot that it says you can vote for casinos in order to improve the economy and produce more aid to education. So if you believe in those two things, you vote for casinos. So they just pulled it a couple of days ago with this new language without any of the negatives. They don't give you any reason why you shouldn't be in favor of it. They only give you these reasons why you should. In the ballot itself, and it bumped up a few points because obviously people like a stronger economy and people like aid to education. So they have, let's just say, to speak with great moderation, this has not been a model of transparency and good government. There has been a single public hearing. There hasn't been a single independent study or anything like of that nature. It's just been talking points from the industry and kind of heavy-handed, top-down kind of manipulation of the process. But it's
about... I just want to make one observation, which is how bogus this argument about earmarking is. The idea that the money that we raise from this particular government activity is going to go for something really, really good, and therefore you ought to support
it. Well, you know...
In fact, all these funds are fungible. They can go to any... I mean, the state budget is the state budget. And
a dollar is a dollar.
It doesn't matter where it comes from. Right. And the decision about how you spend your money and how you raise it are two completely separate.
But can you imagine putting on the initiative language itself the argument for the initiative? So that just gives you an example of, you know, New York has always been a top-down state. It's always been, you know, three guys in a room. And and historically, I go into this in my book, there's always been a kind of a bipartisan agreement between the Tammany Hall, you know, the Democratic Party bosses that have run New York City historically, and the Republican machine that has had sway in much of the rest of it. They've all agreed on this. They've all agreed for many years, even when the Constitution prohibited it. They've all agreed that they wanted to have gambling in New York because why? It takes a lot of money from vulnerable people and delivers a healthy take of it to politicians. And this has always been very desirable for New York politicians. And in some ways, the way they want, what they want to do now is just continue that tradition. But one of the things I try to say in the report is, while that cynical reading of New York history is certainly there, there have also been really terrific New York leaders like Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, who fought this with everything he had. Governor Charles Evans Hughes, Governor and then later President Theodore Roosevelt, the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who fought like a tiger to keep them from turning Governor's Island into a big casino. So so there have been great New York leaders who we remember with great fondness, and we do not remember really the names of the political leaders who have just been these machine hacks who wanted gambling in order to feed themselves and the political machine.
You think you've got any prospect of stopping this freight train coming down the track?
Well, we haven't got much on our side, but good arguments in shoe leather, and the other side has a lot of money, but I think we might have enough because there's...
Has the Archdiocese spoken out on this?
You know, they have. They put out a pastoral letter this yesterday and saying they did not instruct the faithful how to vote, but they said they had some serious concerns about this measure, and that was a wonderful thing for the bishops to do.
Yeah. Listen, David, need to terminate our conversation now with gratitude for you coming on and sharing with us. And thanks a lot. Best of luck to you in your campaign.
Thank you, Glenn. I've enjoyed the conversation. Hope we can do it again soon.
We will, no doubt. Take care. Bye.